Israel has often been called a colonial settler state by its critics. But was that how the Zionist movement started out? KGVM contributor David Rosenberg spoke with Brown University professor Omer Bartov about the history of the movement and the problems associated with it.
The whole idea of Zionism, you know, it's often presented by its critics and opponents as just yet another form of settler colonialism. And the people who have supported it over the years have always seen it as a way to achieve self-determination for the Jewish people. Where do you come out on that? Was the Zionist idea from its origins really a form of settler colonialism, or did it get distorted into that? It seemed like the leaders of the early Zionist movement deliberately kind of promoted it as that. You know, we could be an outpost of Western civilization in the Middle East, that kind of thing.
Well, look, I mean, Zionism is a complicated phenomenon, an idea that changed over time. Originally, Zionism is a nationalist ideology. It's an ideology that was created in response to other ethno-nationalisms in Eastern Europe, where most of the Jews were living. And those ethno-nationalisms, as they evolved in the late 19th century, began seeing what was called the Jewish masses living there as unwanted and as not belonging to those parts of the world, and evolved their own anti-Semitic ideology about Jews. So one of the responses, initially not the most popular among the Jews, but one of the responses was to say, well, the Jews too are a people, a nation, and as a nation, they also have a right of self-determination, as all other nations do. The Poles, the Ukrainians, the Hungarians, and so forth. And the problem, of course, for Jews living in Eastern Europe was that unlike these other groups, they had no claim on the territory in which they lived. And ethno-nationalism is both about the ethnos, the group, and the territory where it lives. And so Zionism evolved an argument that its territory was the historic, mythical, ancestral homeland of the Jews, which was Palestine, or as the Jews refer to it, Eretz Israel. So in that sense, it begins as a nationalist movement, and it has all the ingredients of ethno-nationalism, not all of which are particularly nice, because these tend to be very aggressive movements. Once the Zionists succeed in beginning to bring Jews to Palestine and to settle the land, then first of all, yes, they become, and quite consciously and deliberately, they come to settle the land. They become people who colonize and settle the land. That's how they speak about themselves. We don't need other people to say that about them. And secondly, as they do that, they encounter the indigenous population that already lived there. And that's the Arabs who are later known to us as Palestinians, so Palestinian Arabs. That creates a conflict. And that conflict, from the point of view of the Palestinians, is a conflict with settler colonialism. That's not precisely the way the Jews, the Zionists, see it, because they see themselves as coming home to their ancestral land, and also as escaping violence by other ethno-nationalists in Europe. But that's definitely the way the Palestinians see it from their point of view. There's no question about it. So that's the ambivalence that Zionism has, and it has it until 1948, of both providing increasing shelter for Jews who are increasingly persecuted and eventually murdered in Europe, and as the numbers in Palestine grow, the conflict with the Palestinians grows as well. After 1948, Zionism becomes, as I've written in my book, a state ideology. And so because Israel does not agree on a constitution and never has one, Zionism becomes the ideology of the state. And as such, it does become not only a sort of colonial ideology, but a militaristic, expansionist, centralizing, exclusive, and eventually an ideology of ethnic cleansing, and as of October 7th, also a genocidal ideology. That's not how it begins, but that's, and maybe it was not, you know, could have been predetermined, but that's how it evolved and became what it is now. And the ideology of Zionism right now, and it is a political ideology. It's not, people like to think about it as their identity. It's not an identity. You may accept it or not, support it or not. It's an ideology. As an ideology, I don't think it's any longer supportable. And the state of Israel will exist as a much healthier, more humane and democratic state without Zionist ideology.
So, is it possible, you think, for the state of Israel to exist without what some call its obsession with the 51% majority? Well, it's at 80-20 now, but is it possible for Israel to transform itself into not a Jewish state, to have a transformation, something like what happened in South Africa, where South Africa wasn't destroyed, it just changed its system? Not that all the problems were solved there, but
Right.
at least you had one person, one vote.
So, first of all, Israel is not really an 80-20 state. It's a 50-50 state.
Oh, if you
Because
take
Israel,
all the territories, yeah.
because there is actually only one state between the Jordan and the sea. And there's 7 million Palestinians and 7 million Jews in that territory. There are 40 million people altogether. Of those 7 million Palestinians, 2 million are Israeli citizens with limited rights. And the rest have no rights at all. They're living under arbitrary military rule. And of course, in Gaza, they're living also in a complete and total humanitarian disaster. Is it possible? Well, in fact, I think it's the other way around. I think the only way for the state of Israel, however it is redefined, to exist as a member of the international community is to do away with this kind of Zionist ideology, which has made it already into, in parts of the areas it controls, into an apartheid state, and is rapidly making it into a full-blown apartheid state. And as such, yes, you can imagine that in the long run, its fate will be like that of South Africa. So it has to reform. If it doesn't reform, it will become, as it is becoming now, an isolated, impoverished, pariah state, from which most Jewish communities around the world will also need to separate themselves because of the threat it poses to them by being the main trigger for anti-Semitism around the world today. If it does not do that, as many of its defenders claim, and they think that they're defending it, maybe some in good faith, it is facing a very dire future. And I would add that we see that also in the international arena, despite the fact that for 2.5 years, the international community provided Israel with total impunity in its policies, both in Gaza and the West Bank, and now also in Lebanon. The sentiment, the popular sentiment, and the political sentiment now, including in the United States, is turning against Israel. And if Israel doesn't change, then the politics vis-à-vis Israel will change.
The defenders of Israel will listen to what you're saying and what other critics are saying, and they'll say, "You're trying to destroy Israel. You don't accept our right to exist." And how do you break through that ideological mindset? Will it be just a matter of necessity that people will finally realize we can't live like this?
Yeah, it's I hate to do that, but I will quote the mayor of New York, Mamdani. Israel exists. It doesn't need the right to exist. It exists as a state. It is a member of the international community. It is recognized by the UN. So nobody needs to walk around saying, "I recognize the right of Israel to exist." Its right was already recognized in 1948. So that's a totally hollow argument. The question is what kind of state it will be. There were many states in the past, certainly in the middle of the 20th century, that had absolutely abysmal, horrifying genocidal ideologies, and those states, those regimes, were destroyed in war, in conflict. The states have remained, and the state of Israel will remain. The question is, what kind of state will it be? Will it be a Jewish supremacist state, which will make the life for Jews around the world terrible and will make it into a full-blown, as I said, racist apartheid state? Or Can it reform itself? Can it change to make the lives of its own citizens, first of all, Jews and Palestinians alike, better, and will make it into a more acceptable member of the international community? That is the question. So it's not about me saying it has a right or doesn't have a right to exist. Of course it has a right to exist. And I say one other thing, because it's true that it has become somewhat popular, certainly among some young American Jews and some Europeans and some supporters of Palestinians, to say that they're anti-Zionist. I find this designation not very helpful, because if what you mean by saying you're anti-Zionist is that you say the Jews have no right to self-determination, then you have to be consistent. Then you should say, well, no one has a right to self-determination. I don't like nationalism. Now, I personally actually think that nationalism was a terrible idea, but we live in a world of nations, and none of us wants to be without citizenship. We know that being stateless is not a good situation to be in this world, whatever we may think of nationalism. So if you are an anti-Zionist, be consistent and say Jews have no right of self-determination, Palestinians have no right of self-determination, nobody has that right per se. So I don't think that's a very useful designation. I think that Zionism as a political ideology has run its course. It has become so perverted that I don't think it can reform itself. I think the state can and must reform itself, and it needs to think of itself eventually as a state of all its citizens, which is a term that was already popularized in the 1990s during the Oslo negotiations, and was assassinated alongside Rabin, who was then the prime minister of the state of Israel, because of incitement by Netanyahu in particular, and now the kinds of people who are around him who do want a Jewish supremacist state and will never accept the idea of a state being the state of all its citizens, which is what we understand as a democratic liberal state.
I recall the Indian spiritual teacher Jay Krishnamurti talking about nationalism and religion as social diseases, even though I guess in the real world, it's nationalism is a good way to rally your people against a foreign invasion, let's say. But at a certain point, it seems to go awry. In many cases.
Yes, and look, it's like religion. So we can say that religion is the opium of the masses, but religion not only, and nationalism, not only have they not weakened over the last century, in the last several decades, they have increased their hold on people around the world in very different cultural and political contexts. So we have to recognize the reality in which we live. And while, you know, I'm a totally secular person, and I'm not, I wrote a couple of books that are very critical of ethno-nationalism in particular, precisely where Zionism was born. It is a reality that we have to face. And within that reality, we have to try and craft ways or propose ways for states to allow their citizens, all their citizens, all the people under their rule, to live in equality and dignity, rather than to be oppressive of particular groups within their borders.
You do hear about cultural Zionism, you know, the idea that people should go to Israel because they want to be close to the kind of biblical times, I guess, but that's different than what you're talking about, the state ideology, right?
Look, I mean, there were people in the early years of Zionism who believed, including important people like Ahad Ha'am, you know, who believed in the Jews creating some kind of cultural entity in the land of Israel, in Zion, which is the biblical name of Jerusalem, there would be a light unto the nations. Ironically, now, you know, under the current definition of anti-Semitism, which is making the rounds, the IHRA definition, saying that Israel should be measured according to different standards from others is considered to be anti-Semitic. For people like Ahad Ha'am, that was exactly the point, that it would be the city on the hill, as it was called in the United States, that it would be a model for others. So there was a cultural notion of Zionism. In the real world, of course, that was not really doable. And I would say what you mentioned earlier, which is that Zionism appealed for support from other great powers, and in that sense, had a colonial aspect. That is, of course, true, but it was also very much part of the situation of the Jews at the time when Theodor Herzl, the founder of political Zionism, appealed to the Ottoman Sultan, to the German Emperor, and when eventually the Jews got the support of the British Empire, they were doing that because they were powerless. They were doing that because they didn't have a state that would support colonization. They needed some state, and they eventually were lucky and smart enough to get the British Empire to support them. And what most people in Israel would deny is the obvious fact that there would not have been a proto-state in Palestine without the support of the biggest empire in the world at the time, the British Empire, both through the Balfour Declaration and then the Mandatory Papers. So in the 1920s and 30s, Jewish colonization of Palestine is very much with the support of the British. But that was the only way that it could be achieved. And those Zionist leaders, such as Weizmann and Ben-Gurion, were quite pragmatic people, and they knew that they needed imperial support for their own political goals.
And yet it ended up that the Jews had to fight the British to create their state. And the first country to recognize Israel was the Soviet Union because they thought it was a blow against British imperialism.
This is part of the irony of history. So without the Balfour Declaration and the British Mandate, there would not have been a proto-state in Palestine. But of course, in 1936, the Palestinians rise up against Jewish colonization. And by 1939, the British were facing another world war, decide that they have to hedge their bets, and they issue a paper. And the White Paper reneges on the promise of the Balfour Declaration and the mandate, and says there will be an Arab state with a Jewish minority, not a Jewish national home. They claim that that's a fulfillment of the commitment, but obviously they're actually reneging on it. And they close down, in large part, immigration into Palestine precisely when Jews are in dire need of it. And that creates an enormous amount of resentment within the Zionist leadership, the entire Yishuv, the pre-state Jewish community. And during World War II, as you remember, Ben-Gurion issues the statement that we will fight the Nazis as if there are no British, and we will fight the British as if there are no Nazis. But in fact, during World War II, the Jews are in league with the British. My own father served in the Jewish Brigade of the British Army to fight the Nazis. Once that war is over, two things happen. First, the Jews can turn against the British rule in Palestine, but two, the British no longer want to rule Palestine. They are exhausted and they just want to leave. And so when Israel issues its Declaration of Independence in 1948, or officially it's a proclamation of a state that is known in Israel as the Declaration of Independence, it's not clear who they are becoming independent from because it's issued about 8 hours before the British actually leave Palestine with the knowledge that the mandate is over. So the British are leaving not because of Jewish resistance, they're leaving because the empire is exhausted, and they are leaving it in dire straits because there is already an ongoing civil war there, and they just pack their bags and leave. And yes, indeed, they did not vote in favor of the partition of Palestine, an idea that was originally floated by the British, by the Peel Commission in 1937. That's the first time that there is actually a proposal for the creation of two states. It's originally a British idea. By 1947, they no longer support it.
Do you think that if the Jews who had survived World War II would have been allowed to go where many of them wanted to go, to say the US or Canada or Britain, if those countries had let them in, would history have been different? Would there have been enough Jewish people in Palestine to create the State of Israel?
So demographically, At the end of the Holocaust, the Yishuv, the pre-state Jewish community in Palestine, numbers about 600,000 people. And so it's about a third of the population of Palestine. Two-thirds are Palestinian. And it's clear that however many people come from Europe, the masses that were expected to come and to make a Jewish state into a Jewish majority state no longer exist. They've mostly been murdered. So the dynamic of what happens in 1948, that is the Nakba, the ethnic cleansing of the majority of the Palestinians in what becomes the state of Israel, is really the other mechanism of creating a Jewish majority state. So that's the sort of general outline, I would say. But within that, it's a good question as to how many Jews would have come to Palestine right after 1945 had they been able to go elsewhere. Most of them, certainly after the pogrom in Kielce in Poland, most of them don't want to go back east. So they want to go west, mostly to North America. That's the main destination, or to Palestine. Now, the evidence is that there were many, many Jews who wanted to go to Palestine, possibly the majority in the immediate aftermath of the war in the DP camps. Over time, the enthusiasm for going to Palestine diminishes somewhat. And in 1948, when the U.S. allows large numbers of Jews to enter, and it takes the U.S. 3 years to agree on that, many do go to the United States. So that changes over time, in part because what they see as insecurity in Palestine, and these are people who have lived through hell already, and in part because, people want to go to where their families are. They realize that their families are already in North America and they want to join them and they want to have a decent life for themselves. So it's a bit hard to say, but I don't think that would have made a major difference one way or the other. The fact of the matter is that in 1948, in the war of 1948, about a third of the soldiers who fight in IDF uniforms, once the IDF is created in April 1948, are survivors, and large numbers of them die. So there is I would say, especially among the young survivors, men and women, there is a kind of Zionist idealism that in part has to do with their upbringing even before the Holocaust, in part has to do with their experience during the Holocaust, and in large part has to do also with the emissaries, shlichim, those emissaries who are sent from Palestine to encourage Zionism among the inmates of or the residents of these displaced persons camps. The visit by Ben Gurion to those camps is greeted with huge enthusiasm by large numbers of people there, and to go not only by my father's experience but other accounts, and members of the Jewish Brigade, when they encounter, and they're wearing British uniforms with yellow stars of David on their shoulder tags, are greeted with enormous pride and enthusiasm by survivors, certainly the young ones. So one shouldn't underestimate the sort of, I'd say, emotional and ideological Zionism among people living in the DP camps, and especially among the young, many of whom just want to have a sense of dignity, of self-assertion. And in some ways, eventually, that's translated also into a willingness to carry out violence against Arabs as a kind of substitute to the Germans they fought. They could not fight to the Germans who were killing them, and to feel that they are fighting at last for their own existence and survival.
Omer Bartov is a professor of Holocaust and Genocide Studies at Brown University. He spoke with KGVM contributor David Rosenberg. This interview was released on May 28th, 2026.